This is an inaugural thing that's happening right here.
Shedcast.
We're going to bake ourselves in here for a bit.
Oh.
What do you think it is? I don't know. It's maybe 85.
Is it even? I was thinking it was like 65. It's beautiful outside. I'm not sweating at all.
It's not bad.
It's lovely.
So we're back on the podcast, and I have not made a podcast since, I don't know. It was a bad thing that happened because this is very unlike me to start something and then not continue going on it. Either that or I just completely abandon and say, hey, I'm never doing this again because I didn't like doing it. But I didn't do that. I just got really busy with videos.
I think that's probably more the fault of the listening audience. More than anything, you know, if you don't tune in, he has no reason to do this again. I'm just saying.
That could be.
Yeah, so it's really your fault.
But there's a lot of people who have been asking me, why have you not been making podcasts? And I said, I've been making videos. Mm. I've been trying to make 3 videos a week.
That's a lot.
For this whole season. And I've been pretty successful a couple months, maybe in the summer here, where I've maybe done 2 a week and not 3. But just depends.
Yeah, that's hard. I don't really think a lot of people know, especially given the quality of the videos that you make, mm-hmm. how much time and energy goes into that. Mine are extremely low quality, like Sesame Street.
I don't think we'd go that far.
It's, well, you're right. It's not that good. No, it's worse than that. It's one take. I do one take. I have no artistic ability with a camera whatsoever.
Well, see, the one take thing, though, is actually, I wish I could do that because I can't do it. I really just get in front of the camera and just blab for a while, and then I think, no, that doesn't sound good. I'm going to erase that. And then we'd go again until eventually we get somewhere.
I don't know. I don't know. 40 or 50 camera shots to show how you pick up a box is really impressive. I just don't even show the box.
Yeah. So that's where we're at with the podcast thing here. But John Perry's here today. And
hello.
So he told me, hey, I'm going to be in Omaha. I should probably come to somewhere near Des Moines where you live since it's not that far away. And here he is.
Yeah. Yeah, it worked out really well. This is a 48-hour trip for me, and I'm here for a wedding, and then I'm going right back home, so just a quick one out, and how could I miss the opportunity?
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you very much for stopping by, bringing a challenger that we might race later.
That's right, we're going to race.
Yeah.
You're going to, you know, win.
Because I believe yours is a V6.
Five, maybe. 5.5.
Yeah.
I lost one of the cylinders along the way because I really pushed it a little harder than
yeah.
I should have.
I believe yours is the V6 version, and not that mine's really that much faster. I will say a lot of people think that when you have a Challenger that it's got to be extremely fast, but the 5.7 is even not that fast. So,
you know, I actually, now that we're speaking Mopar for a moment, I was very impressed with how quick that thing was, and I knew it was a V6, and still, I mean, that thing, it took off. Plus, it was getting like 28 miles a gallon on the way out here. That doesn't make any sense.
That's the 8-speed transmission in
yours.
I do not have that.
Oh, you
I
got
have
like
the old
six,
five.
Five. Wow. You're all torque, buddy.
Yep.
That thing will just rip.
The low end, second gear, that's where it's at.
Drag racing mode. Nice. Yeah, we'll chest it out later. We'll see who can go farther on a tank of gas.
So the thing that I was going to do was have like a bunch of questions planned for you, and you do what you're supposed to do when you do an interview with someone, where you do some preparation, some research, and all that stuff. But I didn't do that today.
Perfect.
I just figured we'd just have a conversation, see where it goes.
Off the cuff.
Just like that.
Yeah, just bring it.
That's probably another thing with the podcast that people don't realize when you interview people is that you have to kind of know what you're going to say, where you're going to take the conversation, or otherwise it gets a bit weird.
Yeah, sometimes there should be some sort of goal. There is no goal here today. There's no goal. Eventually we'll be like, you good? And then, okay.
Yeah.
And that'll be it.
But John has a lot of interesting stories from when he grew up, I believe, because I know some of them.
Yeah, a couple.
And so I think we should go all the way back to the beginning.
Mm.
And first, let's talk a little bit about what we were just speaking about out front in my house a little bit about your tie to Iowa and kind of how that works.
Great. Yeah. Okay. So my, both my grandmother and grandfather were born here, plus a lot of extended family. I don't really know when they settled into Iowa. I thought that even my great-great-grandfather was in Iowa. Well, I mean, we're going way back. But my family has a 150-year-old farm in Rose Hill, Iowa, that I have not been back to visit in about 4 years. But as a kid, I came out here every summer. My great-uncle farmed the land that was in the family for a long time, and that is still being farmed. And it's, you know, just a quiet little place. Population about 8. I think there's 8 people in Rose Hill. As many letters as there are in the name of the town, there are that many people still there.
So you do have some familiarity then with kind of what we deal with here and during the summer and all that. How long did you spend? Was it just like a trip that you go on every summer, or you spend extended time
there? Yeah, a week or so is really it. You know, a couple times in the winter, but... like much of the plains, humidity, you know, the air tends to really settle in and get thick in the summertime, and you miss, like, we've had a little breeze today, which has been nice, and that's not common.
No.
So, you know, you can have some adverse growing conditions, but on the flip side, great moisture, great soil, you know, God's country and all that.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that are surprised, I think, when I talk about our crops here and stuff, that don't realize that we don't have any irrigation. Coming from the western states, there's a lot of people who, I mean, they would just never think about it. They don't know any other way.
Correct.
But yes, we, I mean, anywhere around here, there's really no irrigation on our fields. It just is all natural, whatever happens. So that's, I think, as a kid, growing up in a farming area too, I would hear the farmers a lot talk about what's going on, and they would always be worrying what's going on and weather-wise and all that stuff. And I'm getting a little more appreciation for it, taking care of even my yard with when it rains and all of that being kind of a natural process. But
yeah, when you live and die by the weather and farming, and that's really how it's always been. You get in too late into the field, too early, have a drought, have flooding. I mean, you think about the flooding that's been happening this year. Seeing that when I was flying in was it's amazing how much water is out there and how far behind the crops are that did make it through.
Yep.
And then how far behind people were that, you know, that planted. Here, I mean, you haven't really had those same effects because it's a little more rolling hill country.
Yep.
And, you know, from Omaha and moving a little more to the west, the Ogallala out there is, a, you know, that massive, aquifer that took me a minute there, I think has really filled in a ton this year. But that, so what Ryan was talking about with irrigation, once you get past Omaha and you start traveling further west, like all of those fields are under pivots because there's so much water. And there is a big difference between, you know, a farm here that could be growing 180, 200 bushel corn. When a guy's irrigating 100 miles from here, he's it could be a 220, 240, 250 just because there's more, I guess, less concern with the weather and really having to worry about that.
Yeah. The other thing too here is I don't know why I never realized how much corn being kind of like a warm season plant and just all of that heat that we get right at the right time during July, August here. And then if we do get the rain, like I think this month we've had maybe about 5 or 6 inches of rain. And so it's perfect. It's like perfect timing with the weather, how hot it is and all that.
Yeah, it is true that you can in July sit and hear the corn grow. If you're out in the middle of a field, you can hear the leaves beginning to pull away from the stalks. There's this crackling that happens, and you literally can hear that. It's pretty neat to be out there.
Then it is our very humid time here, for sure. Definitely the humidity, you will... I mean, you spend a ton of time in the South, so you can kind of know, but it's not really a whole lot different during some of our warmest periods.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it depends, right? So Georgia, Georgia would have more heat than you're typically used to here. Humidity similar. You know, you're going to be in the 80%, upper 80% into the 90% on a pretty regular basis. And in Florida, you know, forget about it. It's not really a humidity meter. It's just like, how wet are you going to be?
Yeah,
it doesn't
exactly
really matter. It's just soaked all the time. Yep. So yeah, but this is nice. I looked at it a little bit ahead before I came out. I think, you know, humidity was going to be like 70-some-odd percent, and that feels great. I mean, I'm very happy about it. It's actually a big break from the 90s where I've been, so can't complain.
I was explaining dew point to Connor the other day.
He doesn't know what that is.
He did not. He said, well, what is our dew point here? And I said, well, you don't have a dew point because we have a dew point, but you do not have a heat index. That's what he said. What is my heat index? I said, well, you're not dealing with the humidity factor in making a temperature actually feel different than it is. He's like, we have humidity here.
Well,
I looked at his dew point that day, and it was 40.
Right. That would be more accurate. Actually, this morning, so when I left Utah this morning, it rained yesterday. Great, wonderful rain. Didn't expect it to do as much as it did. Really cooled things off. It was only like 62 degrees during the day, which was beautiful. And I have all my windows open at night because I don't have AC there. It gets cool at night, normally in the 50s in the summertime at my house. So 90s in the day, 50s at night. It's a hell of a spread. And every window was fogged up this morning, and I had never seen that before.
Really?
Yeah. There. Never seen it.
Last week it was 2 weeks ago when it was 115 heat index here. Our low for the evening was 83.
That's no fun.
And I'm growing cool season grass.
Ah, look at it. It's doing great. You know, it just goes on vacation. I mean, that's really all you have to think about. Like, cool season grass is a lot like a snowbird. You know, it's a New Yorker. Mm-hmm. Except, you know, it's like it's spending the nice cool time, enjoying itself. And as soon as it starts to get hot, it leaves. And it looks like it dies, but it doesn't.
Yep.
It just pops back up. It's like, yeah, I'm going to take a break. I don't have the energy to grow. I'm going to dry out for a minute and go underground. And then they come back out, and they're just, you know.
But I'm forcing it to not take a break.
Because you're irrigating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but looking around, even then, the natural grasses are very green right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can tell that.
We've had good water this year.
Yeah.
Because normally right around this time of year, if we didn't, everything would be pretty toasty.
That makes sense.
Yep.
Yeah. So what has been, I'm going to interview you now. So what has been your biggest
challenge
to overcome here, Mr. Knorr, on your personal property? What are you struggling with?
I'm struggling with what exact height I want to keep my grass at, because I got into the tall thing and it does really work for sure in holding a lot of the stress away and all that during the summertime. But once I started doing real mowing, started doing the shortcut thing, I really like that look of that grass.
You're having some serious grass people problems right now.
Yes.
Yeah. That's
yep.
Huh. If that's all you have to worry about, I think you're going to be okay.
Yeah. But I do like it. I like it a little bit taller. Our backyard here gets so much sun during the day. Well, all day long, morning, all the way to afternoon, all the way to night, all day.
If you wonder why we keep looking that, it's because we're looking at the backyard. I just keep going that way and looking outside.
It's like, it's over there.
Oh, it's right there. It's just right there.
But I think I could still do it. I think I could go a little shorter on it for sure.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, if you have access to water, just start bringing it down. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't work,
you can always go back the other way.
Just grows.
Yeah. Of the things I think that I thought about the most with real mowing when I first started doing that, and there was a lot of people kind of saying, "Oh, it'll never work." I'm like, "Well, if it doesn't work, I can just go back to the way it was before."
Yeah, that's right. It's grass is easy to fix. I mean, as long as you don't kill it all on accident with a chemical. Everything else is very adjustable.
Or on purpose.
Well, right, on purpose. I mean, yes, okay, but I mean on accident. Like, there, you know, not to, like, mince any words, but there's a lot of people who say, you know, I've got weeds in the driveway, I buy Roundup for it, right? They look at that and they say, I can spray this on the lawn, too. That still happens. It's pretty common. And, you know, if you don't know that there's a difference in how a non-selective versus a selective herbicide works, you can kill a lawn very quickly.
Yeah.
And it does still happen. You know, that might seem like something that doesn't anymore, but I, honestly, and this kind of goes into the consumer side a little bit, when Scotts released Roundup for lawns.
That's what I was just going to say, is they really confused a lot of people too.
They did. The only real marking difference, if you weren't paying attention, the only difference is a red cap versus a blue cap. Mm-hmm. And that isn't enough, because you know, people before were like, no, I just use Roundup for everything. I mean, even if they did, they would go maybe spray a weed in their lawn. They didn't really care if it burned a hole in it. So, but other people were like, oh, I can just put this on everything. So there was some confusion there. But it was, it's also really a great over-the-counter product. I mean, it cleans up 4 different active ingredients. You know, it really does a good job. But if you don't know any better, and somebody just, you know, you were at your buddy's house and, you know, having a barbecue, and it's like, wow, you don't have any weeds. Like, yeah, I use this stuff. You go over there and, like, get, you know, red cap and kill it all. And
yeah, because all you're really looking at is the thing that says Roundup on
just
it.
Just says Roundup.
And so they're like, oh, I can just use Roundup. Well, no, big difference.
There's a big difference. There is a big difference. And so that does happen, overuse of chemical, those types of things. But, you know, your lawn will recover from heat stress, you know, overwatering, funguses, unless, you know, you really let that go.
Yeah.
That can take a while to come back. Fertilizer burns, most of those things you can recover from. Short mowing, so it looks ugly for a week. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people just need to relax. It's like, it's going to be fine. It's just grass. Haircuts, though, I mean, you know, that's a real problem. People get a bad one of those. That's really, because that never grows back.
Looking at my lawn here, the taller stuff, and we're looking out here again, but if I were to go, let's just say someone wants to start going shorter on their yard. I think Connor has talked about this quite a bit. Do you need to think a little bit about thinning it out a little bit at that point, too, because it's gotten so thick and tall here that it's going to have a tough time, especially with a rotary mower, of getting down there? And
yes. The thing that I first, I'll preface it this way. If you're going to have short grass, plan on being out there with your mower every other day at the least, and you can mow every day. So if you got that kind of time, it's fun to do. If you're planning on going from a higher grass height and you want to take it down, you've got to go down slow. You can still do it in relative terms pretty quick, but I would take a half inch off. I'd come right back at it the next day with another half inch. I'd wait a day, then do it again at another half inch. I just keep cutting it down because, you know, depending on the time of year, you'll gain almost a quarter inch of growth in 24 hours. So it comes up anyway. So you're just going to be like taking that plant down and down. Now, as grass gets taller, it forms a little bit of a stronger stalk at the bottom, and it gets a little bit thicker. And you'll see that if you really peel back the grass, it looks more like it's a stem rather than a leaf. So if you go too short too fast, you expose all the stems, and that does not look good. And then you can have some issues with the plant like getting too hot because there's nothing shading the crowns, right? Like you don't have anything covering the ground. And so you can run into greater damage that way. So it's good to just sort of take it down slow until you get to that desired height and then go for it. Unless it's really early in the season. Again, I mean, I don't care. If somebody wants to cut it down right away, have at it. I will tell you this, bag it if you're going to do it.
Yeah.
That's what I would suggest when you're taking it down in the beginning. You don't want to just keep stacking up clippings because that's going to end up being an enemy before too long too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
that makes sense. It's a question that I think a lot of people have now that they've seen a lot of real mowing being done. Maybe it wasn't something that a lot of homeowners even thought they could do before, myself included. I just was like, no, it's like something that I could never do.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you did, like you're doing, with a manual real mower, it is a quality cut. It looks fantastic.
It doesn't. The only thing, I was talking to Ryan about this earlier, it will not stripe unless I wanted to put something on there to do that. It's just, that's not my goal. I mean, I was looking at his and I'm like, man, maybe that should be my goal. But it just, it does. It cuts really, really well. And you have to know that for me, I've been using just a push reel mower for, it's been a long time actually. I bought one when I lived in California because I had a small bit of grass there. So like 11 years, but prior to the home that I'm in now, there was a little space where I had a big yard. It was like 16,000 square feet. And I always had a Honda 21-inch self-propelled that I had for years, years and years. Because I cut grass from the time I was a kid, you know, up through my teens, and paid for all my toys doing it that way. And I had this one Honda. Man, it had to have been 25 years old, and thing cut fantastic. So I used that for the most part up until I got into this house, and I gave that mower away.
Okay.
So, but I do like, I like the push reel. I mean, if it was over, if I had a 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 square feet or above, forget it. Yeah. You know, there's no reason to do that. It's a novelty at that point. But, you know, I have a small lawn, 1,500 square feet. It's easy. It's fast. And I can get creative. I have two of them. So I have one at one height and one at another. So I kind of like, oh, I'm just going to grab that one and do this one. You know, but I don't have like nine.
Yeah.
I don't even know how you have space for all these mowers that are here. It's like around the ceiling.
You got plenty of space in here.
Yeah, I don't know.
Plenty of space.
You know, ride on is what you need, like a big bat wing. It's a huge one. Something you could cut in one pass.
So let's go back to your story a little bit and growing up. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about that, kind of where you grew up, how it progressed into where you moved to and all that different things.
Sure. So I'm from Houston originally. I'm a St. Augustine boy as far as grass is concerned. My mother had like a sort of a hobby business. She was a landscaper. And now it's more than, I should clarify that. It was probably more than a hobby. When my sister and I, my older sister and I were little, we rode around in a stakeside Datsun. So she could put bark and all kinds of stuff in that thing. So she'd just tie us around the neck with bungee cords into the thing. And then we'd go to jobs with her. So, I mean, for me, even as a baby, I was out on those jobs, like out, you know, doing a landscaping thing. And I started mowing the grass at my house when I was seven, I think, is when they started me pushing the snapper that we had, the snapper at the time. And so I mowed that St. Augustine twice a week, grew super fast in the Texas heat. And I always loved it because we also had a swimming pool. So that was every time the bag got full, I went in there. And then I went back and I emptied the bag and I mowed more. And by the time I was hot again, the bag was full. So I get back in the pool and that was wonderful. It was great. Mm-hmm. When I was about 10, I started mowing other people's lawns. Like that was just like any kid, I guess, in the 80s at that point. After that, the company that my dad worked for sold. My family of six moved into a motorhome and we partridge familyed, basically. Lived in a bus, and we traveled the U.S., Mexico, and Canada for a little over a year. And
so how many people in the bus then?
Six and two dogs.
Okay.
Six and two dogs in a 35-foot Bluebird Wander Lodge. I mean, you know, it was a bus. It was like a big, it was fun. It was great. So, you know, it was different. It was a cool year. I was 12 at that point. I turned 12 on the road and then turned 13 before we moved to Park City. We actually spent the winter there and skied and did that kind of thing and decided to move there. So that was around 1991, 92, somewhere in that range. And then it kind of just picked up, you know, life then came like what it was before, you know, at 13, 14 years old, I started cutting grass again. So I took care of three places right there and gave my little weekly thing. And that was just kind of it. As a teenager then, I went to work at the Park City Nursery, which is still going. Ann and Steve Barrett owned it at the time. They sold it a couple years ago. And I planted trees. I started there when I was 16. And I just sort of always had that love of the outdoors and the, you know, the fun aspect of watching things grow. And it just kept going. It's just still going. I'm still cutting freaking grass. It's just that's all still the same. Just for myself now, so that's nice.
Yeah. And so then, so you were living basically full-time in Utah mm-hmm. then since about 13-ish then?
13 years old, yeah. I was there until I started my business in 2002, and that led me to working in Reno as well. So I was going back and forth between Reno, Nevada and Utah and spraying trees and lawns and doing that kind of thing. And the business in Reno really took off. So my wife at the time, so I like to refer to that. We moved out there in 2007 after me commuting back and forth for like 4 years.
So was there anything that led you to that part of the business? I mean, moving past kind of just mowing, but then moving into the spraying and that part of it, which is a very different aspect of it.
Very different. So when I was working at the nursery, we were in the midst of a pretty heavy drought out there from the late 90s to the early 2000s. And I was just concerned with water. Like, it was always about water. Everything was dying because of water. It was water, water. So I started looking for techniques on how to help in droughts and what we could look at for that. And that led me down the polymer road. And I found a guy who had created this machine that was basically like a stand-up aerator that injected polymers, and it had like a fertilizer mixture with it, and you put it in the grass. So I got involved in that as my primary first business. And the problem with it is it lasted, right? Like, you didn't go back to your customers. You saw them once every 5 years, and I was like, well, that's not really going to work very well. So, you know, looking at recurring revenue, the fertilization side sounded really good. And it wasn't just because it was getting the recurring, but since I'd been working with these plants and planting and landscaping for so long, it's like, you know, I could identify the issues and get into it that way. So the big issue was that the polymers were sensitive to salt. So you couldn't do a conventional fertilizer. So that would shorten the lifespan. So that's what led to, we need to go this more carbon-based role, and how can we get a good result with something that's considerably lower inputs, because, you know, the higher amounts of N and phos and potassium, you're putting a lot of salts out, and that would kill those polymers.
Mm-hmm.
So what I found out, this is what the most fascinating thing was to me, was, you know, I could save somebody 50% easy on water, 50, 60% in some cases. They would not have to water as much because the ground stayed moist. Well, getting onto a more like common sense fertility program that was enhancing the soil and enhancing the root zone, they could cut their water by 30 or 40%. And it didn't cost anything extra, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't a 10, 15 cent a foot application. That's expensive.
Yeah.
And that I was like, you know, to hell with this. This doesn't really make any sense to do anymore. We need to just focus on the fertility side and building the soil up. Yes and no. So the guy who invented the machine, I don't know where he is this anymore, but he was a farmer, a sod farmer out of Idaho. And he wasn't very much help, actually. No, I really think about it. The guy who created his polymer slurry was a very smart agronomist. And I didn't really have access to him, just sort of some of the bits of information. Most of it had to come from independent research because there just wasn't enough data. So in the beginning, no, it was like a lot of, I gotta learn this myself. You know, I need to plug in the old modem and hear that sound so that I could read some things that are really hard to find in HTML.
Yep.
And learn. And so I did that, and actually I just read. That was the beauty back in my day, is, you know, you go to the library, like, oh, I'm going to check out some books on this. I'm going to read and like check out these journals and stuff. And so I read and read and read and read, and then, you know, look into the golf side and, you know, started getting into those trades, like the trade magazines, to read what was happening in the industry. And so all of that sort of helped me to get to where I felt like I knew what I was doing then. Then it was trial and error. It was like, okay, so I'm going to try this and see what happens. And, you know, it worked.
Yeah. So when you were starting out with your spraying and doing that, were you automatically going down that road of the more of the soil stuff, or were you kind of in a traditional sense yet, or
just no traditional stuff? Honestly, the last time I spread a bag of fertilizer, the last time was 2003. That's the last time I pushed a spreader. And at that point, it was just to see if there was a difference between what, you know, a conventional fert and what I was doing. That was the only reason. And, you know, you couldn't tell. Like, okay, well, that's that and that's that. So, no, it really was always leading towards the more environmentally forward. I mean, I'll say it. Like, then the buzzword was organic and green and bio, and everything was like, oh, you want to be... It was the front side of the green wave. And I felt as though my company could really be a part of that, just my spray company, and people really liked it. But I didn't want to be organic. Like, that wasn't my goal. I wanted to be limited impact. Mm-hmm. So I had maybe, as the business grew, the spray service, before I sold it, we had just shy of 800 customers out in Reno. And maybe like 4 of them wanted an organic program. The rest just wanted green grass and dead weeds. So however we got there, it just had to get there. Right. Like that's what it was up to. So where I felt good about it was, you know, I was bringing something new that I didn't really have to explain because it was through a service company. It's like, no, we're going to show up 5 times a year. We're going to spray your lawn. We're going to kill your weeds. We're going to, if you want your trees done. So it was very conventional the way it looked. Mm-hmm. But what we were doing in the tanks was totally different. And I found that the less I talked about it, the easier it was to sell.
You're not having to like explain the science. Yeah,
I don't want to do that.
People are just like, hey, it looks good.
Yeah, cool. It's green grass. Well, good job. Green grass. Here's your $20, son. Like, oh, well, you owe me a lot more than that. So,
yeah,
a little bit more, please. But no, that was how it went. And it just grew. It grew really, really fast to the point where there were companies that were asking, of like, what are you doing? What are you using? It's like, well, this is stuff I make over mm-hmm. here. And they're like, great. I need some of that.
So where were you starting to make it at?
Oh, man, humble beginnings. A friend of mine's landscape yard, I mixed my stuff into single totes. I had like a tote, and I'd do it. I'd mix it and blend and make this concentrate. And, oh, God, that was a disaster. Some of the first initial batches. And for, you know, when you're trying to come up with something with new... so many different components into one pot can really cause a problem sometimes. So there's ways that things have to work. You have to mix at certain, you know, temperatures. Certain things have to go first. This requires more time. So that all was a learning curve. And that really, I was able to translate that to Chad Peterson, who's my plant manager, in 2009, I taught him how to do that. But, you know, I'd already been mixing for like 6 years. So when he came on board, the beauty of Chad is he's a perfectionist. And I am not. I am more artistic, which basically means if I throw paint at the wall, I might think it looks good. You know, and they're going to cut in and everything's going to be really...
What if you're
really
both? Because
nice.
That's kind of a nightmare.
No, it's worse. It'd be you. Yeah, you'd be like, I like that splatter, but it needs sharper edges.
That's me.
Yeah, that's bad. That's a bad mm-hmm. combo. So that, you know, it just took, it took years. It took, when I started licensing the company, that was in 2006. So BioGreen had multiple locations at that point. Mm-hmm. It went out of state... In 2007 was when it, 2007? 2008. 2008, the first one officially opened, and that was another out of state. And that was in, I think Chad took that one on. That was Nebraska. Maybe that was 07. It was 07. We had one go into Utah. One went there. We had one in Minnesota. We had two in Florida. One in Texas, one in Colorado. So it kind of, like, we picked up a bunch of locations in the beginning. So I want to say at the end of the first year of licensing, we had like 16 or 17 locations.
Okay.
Something like that.
So that chemistry side of things, obviously the mixing and all that, was that something you were always interested in terms of, I mean, because just thinking about it and thinking about the technical aspect of that, it's not like anyone could just be like, oh, I'm going to mix this to get, like, you have to have a little bit of... kind of knowledge there or
yes.
experimentation that you know a little bit of what you're doing on that. But.
Sure. So, but part of that, I mean, when you're talking about like fertilizing materials blend, mm-hmm. you know, like if you're dealing with NPK, FES, anything like that, you can blend really easily, whether it's dry or liquid. You just have to know what concentrations they can do. When it starts to get difficult is when you start moving into more of the biological side or the organic, the live material and how it interacts with other things. And so a lot of that was actually, it took more time to know. So, you know, we have product on shelves in Georgia that's over a decade old, just to see like how things age out. And that was more the complicated part is you could put something that was alive, and if it got the gas of the nitrogen, it could just freak out on you. And, right. and all of a sudden, you've got foam everywhere. You know, it's blowing out the top. So, no, most of those materials were new. It was just knowing what they did to the soil made me know I had to make them work. Mm-hmm. And that was a little bit more complex at the time. It was actually easy to find individual components, but not a lot of mixed fertilizers that were on both sides of the scale where you were really bridging kind of a standard type of fertility with a more bio-based fertility. That was all still very new and honestly more like witchcraft. I think mm-hmm. people weren't really into that yet.
Yeah. So you went from that. So what happened to your initial company then? You said you started kind of licensing mm-hmm. out. And then from there, how did you get to starting the Green County thing, going down that road?
Great question. So I'll see how quick I can move through that timeline. So we moved everything out to Nebraska in 2009. So Chad was in Nebraska. He started making the product then. We were there until 2013 when I bought our space, our facility in Georgia, and then pretty much everybody relocated there. Green County started in spring of 13, I want to say. Spring of 13, and the reason behind it was to actually bring some private label products to market. We were doing some stuff for companies, and it was kind of white-labeled material. And that was all it really ever intended. That's all we wanted to do with it. And then more and more spray companies were like, well, we want to do this. So the only way you could get our products before is if you were a licensee. Like that was it. So it was very structured. You had like 60, 70, 80 licensees out there that were buying product just direct. They were BioGreen branded or co-branded BioGreen. And so that was it. And so when a company would call and say, hey, you know, my competitor uses you, I'd like to try. I was like, well, that's in an area. It's like protected. They have an exclusive, you know, whatever. So there was that, and there's still a few of those in the cut. There's not that many. There was like two or three. We stopped doing exclusives because we actually wanted to grow. But those guys that have them are the best and still cranking away. So a person that you may see on a regular basis with me is Kyle Verona from Fahey. They're one of their. They still have this spot here, mm-hmm. right down in there. So we started doing some private label of the products to bigger care companies. And so they'd get their own pretty brand name on it. And we did that. And, you know, one day I had like 9 years ago, I had trademarked the N-EXT nitrogen extender. And I didn't ever do anything with it. It was just sitting there. And I was like, you know what? I want to create the next line. I want people asking what's next. Like that was all it was. So simple, very childish mind. And so I said, you know, I've got all these people that want the individual components now. I've been mixing everything together and creating these very robust materials. And now suddenly everybody's like, well, can I just get the humic mm-hmm. or can I just get this and this and that? And I said, well, why don't we just go ahead and do that? You know, we've got the production line. We're doing that. Let's go ahead and have our humic in the next line. Let's go ahead and this and this and this. And there it went. It mm-hmm. just took off suddenly. I mean, it really was. It was like, okay. Yeah.
So how do you think that kind of growth happened there? Because it was all in the pro line at that
point. It was
point.
All pro.
So it was all pro people. Yep. But was there anything you think kind of drove that?
It was very results driven. That's really what it was. And people would talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd be like, oh, yeah, I use that or you know, whatever. You know, we got really active. We've always been very active in the Florida Pest Management Association for about a decade. And so the pest guys who do lawn care, they talk, they share business ideas and they'll like, you know, they'll say, you should call John. He's got some good stuff. So that grew that way. And then we started getting out, we've been going to the GIE for 6 or 7 years, at least 8 years, something like that. And so people would start to see us there. And then, you know, we kind of just ramped up a little, you know, advertising here and there, but it was all pro. And that didn't change until January of 18.
Mm-hmm.
That is the first time that there was any interest to go to the homeowner. I didn't want to do small packaging. In the very beginning, I did that for my spray guys because they're like, just send me like 61-gallon jugs because they're all getting started. And so I'm in there filling 61-gallon jugs. I'm like, ah, I never want to do this again. And back in the day, we did pints and quarts. And we even do like, we've one time filled like 2,400 8-ounce giveaways for a guy who did a trade show in Minneapolis. And I was like, I'm done with bottling. And it wasn't, you know, until Alan showed up to listen to me give a lecture at Real Green and went off and started blabbing about it online. And all of a sudden our phone started blowing up and we had to quickly create a DIY combination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you a little bit about, kind of the whole thing with Alan and Pete as well. Mm-hmm. But Pete, obviously being on the pro side, maybe he knew about it from that too.
So he heard about us through Matt. So Matt Martin was using RGS in his service company. I want to say in 17 is when he was starting to use that. And he knew Pete well. And Pete came and met me at the GIE that year in 2017 and said, you know, I want to start using some of this in my spray business. And so we came up with a plan for his whole idea. And he implemented that and did very well with it. So I think I met him in October. And then that progressed. I think he's the one that's coined the biostimulant. That was his gift. It was like, we called it biostimulant pack.
Yep.
Like, yeah, that's good, Pete. But you know, the rest of it. And again, Alan and Matt, were friends as well. And they had talked a little bit about what we were doing. But Alan came and sat in on a class I gave at Real Green in January of 2018 that was about chemical aeration. And I ran through this whole thing, and that was how we met.
Okay.
And we only met for a second before. In fact, that's a kind of a funny story, is I was standing in the hall about to go in, and I had my coffee cup, and I was exhausted. I was coming in for the, and there's a guy, I don't remember, if you watch this, I can't remember who you were. I'm sorry. But you're like, oh, John Perry. I was like, yeah, hey, how's it going? We're talking. And Alan walked up, and he's like, oh, my gosh, it's the lawn care nut. And I'm like, who the hell is this guy? And I'm like, can I get a picture with you guys? And two of us are like, So that was it. I'm like, I don't know who that is. He didn't know who I am. I don't know who you are. None of us know. I just take a picture, and then we left. So it was about 2 weeks later that our phones just started lighting up, and we had to quickly react and mm-hmm. adjust and change to that.
So did you think it would go kind of as crazy as it has gone?
No, I didn't. I was very, very surprised. In fact, everybody was. We had to hire a lot of people. We had to put a lot of things in place. We put a ton of resources into changing our building around to handle it, which has been an incredible blessing to have this team down there working on it. And I mean, it went from, you know, like having two or three people back there filling to, like, you know, I think just in the middle, in that section, just doing the bottles, I think we have 11 or 12 people that just, all they do is package all day.
Yep.
Just back there packaging, shipping, making sure everything goes in right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a big difference then. I mean, obviously needed a lot more crew there to get it done.
Yeah. I mean, there's more people in production. There's more people in the front office. Everything grew, but just that piece was like, you know, back in the day when Brad and Chad and I were first there, we took shifts on filling buckets for our customers. And so we'd all go back there and we had this wonderful little game of merry-go-round we would play where one guy gets the hammer for one row of buckets. So we'd hammer, bang, 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 get that done, or one pallet, another guy's filling, another guy's stacking, and then we'd rotate, and we just did this like fire drill around the thing, yep. as many out as we could. We always did every aspect of it.
So how did you meet Brad then?
So Brad was a pickup fluke. Honestly, everybody has been. It's one of those interesting things. I had a guy working for me that lived in Naples, Florida. And he went to a, it was like a Rotary Club or small SBA meeting. I don't know what it was, some local thing, town council. And Brad was at this too, and they met, and Brad was doing small business consulting. He had a small business of his own at the time as well. And they started talking about what we did, and he got pretty excited and got on the phone and said, you know, I'd like to help you grow and help with the organization of it, because there was none. Be honest with you, again, not good at that. And you know, he came on board just sort of like freelancing, and we got all of our contact, like every contract was done, you know, correctly at that point. So, you know, our licenses were super tight. Our organization side came from him, from his ability to bring that. And to this day, that, I mean, he runs a very straight line. So this is how we do it. This is just how we do it. You know, so it's very, it's great because he's good at it. And I'm way more fluid, and that doesn't work. When you're growing a big organization, you're branched, and you're all over the country, and in North America, it's like, you can't be like, whatever. It's like, no, there's this hard line that you have to follow in order to keep everything moving correctly. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it makes sense.
But the people that work for me are all very detail-oriented, which is hilarious, because they must just see how much I suffer. I mean, that's all. They have to just know. They're like, this guy needs a lot of help, mm-hmm. like tons of it. And so everyone is. They're very, very detail-oriented. In fact, this is a great story, and a shout-out to Robert, who works at my plant. I was helping them load, one day when I was down there, load all the small packages into the FedEx truck. So we stack pallets out back, and they'd send us a dedicated truck, and we load it at the end of every day. And I'm helping him, and he grabs a box, and he lifts it up, and he sets it inside, and then he goes, that's not right. And he picked it back up. He said, there's only one bottle in this. It's like, it's not right. And I was like, well, maybe it's only supposed to be one bottle. He's like, no. He said, Mr. John, no, that can't be right. I can't let this go. We're going to have to look it up. I said, all right, well, you know, I'll find out. And I get in, I take a look. It's like, oh no, we're sending a single jug to somebody who needed one replaced. He said, okay, all right, but I just, you know, I never want to see anything go out of here where somebody gets something and they don't, and they're surprised when they open the box in a bad way. I said, oh wow, well, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. Like that's like, you know, people will let that go. You're loading 300 or 400 boxes into the back of a truck. One feels weird, you know, like that was pretty cool
yeah.
to see.
That is very detail-oriented.
Yeah, yep. It was nice. I would have been like, man, that's fine.
So then, how did you get into, or when did you start the YouTube side of things?
That's a good question. That's also that. So that was something that Brad had pushed me to do for years, and I didn't want to do it. I honestly never wanted to do it. I liked writing more. Mm-hmm. I liked writing, and I liked speaking, but I didn't really know how to do the camera side of it, and I not how to work it, but I mean, like, you know, talk to this thing. I ended up needing to do it. It became a straight up need of the company that I was going to have to show, you know, like maybe get a little more detailed into what we did as a company, maybe even more from the soil side, explain the products in a little more detail. Because there were so many questions coming from so many different places. So if we got like 50 emails in a week and they all had a similar tone, then I'd need to put a video out about that.
It's like so, send them the info in once instead of...
Right.
Yeah.
That was the whole reason. Initially, I thought it was going to be more like, you know, I'd be sitting there with some of my presentation material and I'm like, this is going to suck. You know, nobody cares about that stuff. So it started to get fun for me. Sometime mid last summer, where I was like, you know, it's kind of fun. You know, you got your audience starts to engage and they're, you know, saying, well, what about this and what about that? And so it gives you content, fresh content to talk about. And I realized after like 15 years of talking about this stuff, there is like so much in here. And these 10-minute sound bites or 15 minutes are really difficult because it's easy for me to talk for 2.5 hours on one topic and then come back from break and keep going.
Yeah.
Like this is just, and you're just like, choo, 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 choo. But so that's been a good learning curve for me to be able to like dude, you just gotta like, you can make 50 videos. You don't have to do it all at once. Yeah. You know, just chill out.
Try to get yourself to be a little more concise on things.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. It's just a rabbit hole in there. I don't know.
Yeah, and that's the challenge with me and like we were talking about, because I try to make it more of a production.
Mm-hmm.
And there's good and bad to that. I mean, it's part of what I do. It's part of the creativity part of it for me. But it does take so much more time, not only shooting things, but the edit part of it is, yeah.
It's great. I mean, that's the thing is you have a very zen way of doing videos. Like I've told you this before. I was just like, you know, I can just sort of sit there and be like, this is like intoxicating. I'm like, wow, how did he do? And then I start really thinking about it. Like, I just saw like 20 different camera moves in the last 8 seconds. And I'm like, how do you even plan that?
Yeah.
You know? Like, I put mine in the bed of my truck once and opened the gate.
I think it's something that does come from the musical side of everything that started for me, because I do see that in my head. And it's kind of like when you write music, there's something that, for most people, when they say, how would you even think about writing a song? It's something that you almost, it's playing in your head.
Yes.
But you can see it. It's a weird thing that happens. It's almost like a state of mind that you're in, kind of. And yeah. But I see the same thing with what I'm doing in my video. So
of course.
Today I'm like, okay, I'm going to set the camera here. The edit's going to go like this. It's going to move to here. And so that does help me with the editing part. Right now I'm working on some client stuff for other people that, even though some of it I've shot, they don't have a direction of necessarily where they wanted it to go. And then I'm trying to dream up what is the story. And when I didn't have it to begin with, it's much more difficult.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. No,
you don't have it.
The song part I got. Yeah. I'll spend a lot of time on a song. But I mean, like the video piece, I'm like, it's just like, I kind of just want to, just give me 10 minutes just sitting there.
Yeah.
And then I'll go. But it is, I have enjoyed a few that I really took my time on, and I was like, no, nobody ever watched them. They're like, sucks. I don't want to sit. It was like,
that is the worst part. Some of the things that you spend the most of your time and energy on, it's like just whatever the case is, it doesn't work out for people to be interested in it. So
there's one video that I shot in the Redwoods in California that I absolutely love. I love everything about it, the music, and it's like, it was very inspiring, because I was like telling family stories and then doing a little, and like nobody cared. Mm-hmm. Like, this guy, who's this guy?
No, I have the exact same thing happen. I made that video about going back to my hometown.
Yeah.
And
that's so nice.
It's kind of like a time of year where people aren't really watching as much because of vacations and whatever is going on. But I was like, man, I spend a lot of time on parts of that, and I really liked it, but it's like, it doesn't get that many views. So.
No, I mean, I think that if we had like a therapy session, you know, it'd be like, John and Ryan solve childhood trauma. Like 6 people would tune in, and then it'd be like, John and Ryan crush a weed under their foot. Like 1,000,000 views.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, well, you know, some things are important.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your music stuff, because I watched the last video and I noticed that you're using one of your songs.
I did.
And I don't think many people noticed. At least I didn't see many comments or anything. Let's kind of talk a little bit about the music side, and you were actually doing some touring and stuff when you were younger.
I did, yeah. I started playing, like, well, I've always played something. My mom got me into guitar when I was like 5. I did that for a few years, and piano until I was like, well, I could still play piano, but I took lessons until I was 10 or 11 or something. And then I relearned guitar when I was 14 or 15. And a perfect teenage story. I met this really super cute girl, and she really liked the Grateful Dead, of course, which I had never heard of. And I was like, well, sweet, I'm going to learn my guitar. And I went and I bought their anthology, the whole catalog of Grateful Dead songs, and then a bunch of albums, and I played along, and I learned every single one of them. Mm-hmm. And then I never got the opportunity to share that with her ever, and never, I don't know where she ended up. Anyway, so I did that, and then I started, like, fooling around writing when I was, like, 16, and my best friend, Boomer, he always wanted to play drums, so we did that. His stepbrother, Mike, he was like, well, I'll learn something. And so we just sort of like learned together, and we played, and we played a lot. In the beginning, we were like a Christian rock band. And we put an album out. A guy heard us play, and he's like, you know, this is great. Let me do it for you. Produce the whole thing. And we did. We played around. We like did a California tour, and we went down into Texas and Colorado and, you know, jumped around a bit. And then as it evolved, played more, you know, locally, club gigs, stuff like that. It kind of got bigger. And then I got out of it. I got out of it in, like, 2003, shortly after I got married. Just kind of stopped, and then I just sort of wrote for myself and had a little studio in my house. And just recently, I'm playing in two bands right now and writing again, which has been really fun. And just having a lot of fun with it. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's cool. But the songwriting side never really stopped. In fact, I've used a ton of stuff throughout the last year and a half that I've written in my videos, that it's usually just these little musical pieces, and nobody really comments on it. The only time anybody really talks about the music is if there's a heavy beat. They're like, ooh, I like that beat. Yeah. You dropped it. I'm like, yeah,
yep.
That was not one I did. So I'm glad you liked it. That's good stuff.
Yeah, that's, it's like, for me, it's a very hard space to get into, and kind of, I don't know why, but you have to be totally committed to it. And a lot of times with the busy life that we have and all of that, mm-hmm. you're just like, if I start writing this song, I'm going to be like here for 6 hours. And,
yes.
You know,
that is how it goes too. You get lost in it really easily. I mean, it's great when they sort of just fall out, you know, you're like, wow, I spent 15 minutes on this and it's fantastic. You know, mm-hmm. it feels good. Everybody's going to like this. And then there's other times like I spent, I rewrote the lyrics to a new song 5 times. The whole song 5 times while I just sat there at my computer. I went through it. I play it, listen to it. I'm like, that's not quite right. And then just scratch and just go from the beginning. And that's, you know, I guess I pay more attention to detail on that than other things.
Yeah. Mm. What's your process with that? Do you have any set process that you do kind of as far as, do you hear words first? Do you get, because for me, I always used to just play guitar.
Yep.
And I'd play around until I was like, oh, something strikes. And then I hear the melody kind of, and I start blabbing words until something just automatically comes out. And then you're like, that's either a good idea or keep thinking.
Yeah, right. You know? I both of those. Sometimes this one song that I recently wrote, I knew what the chorus was because I just could hear it. And I'm like, that's what. Now, how do I build a song around this? Because it's like 2 lines. And you just obsess over those two because, like, God, you could hear people singing along to this. Mm-hmm. But then you got to tell a story to get into it, you know. So then that's all that stuff. Other times I've been, you know, I'd just be like playing. I'm like, this is a cool groove. I like the way this sounds. And then I keep it. And so I use my phone a lot for that stuff. If I'm in one of those moments, I hit that record button and I have it on there so I can come back because I don't always have time. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that. You know, play it back. But I mean, in my lifetime, I've probably written like 600 songs, and out of those, probably like 700 of them were crap, you know? I mean, that's yeah.
Yeah. You know? No, I hear you.
Yeah.
I feel like that a lot of times. There's many times where I'll like hear a verse or something, I'll get it completely done. I'm like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
It's really cool. And then it's like, what else do we have?
I know. I was like, oh, that's a good verse.
After that, you're kind of like either working on it for eternity or at some point you just say, hey, that was a cool verse, but I don't have anything else.
Yeah, that happens too. I mean, and it's easy to get in blocks, you know, like where you're just like, I don't have anything to play.
Yep.
I can play G, C, and D, and now I don't know what else to do anymore. It's mm-hmm. like I'm tired of writing in the same method. So, yeah, but it's fun.
Playing along to other things, like when you first started playing guitar, that was the same as me.
Mm-hmm.
I just was like, I want to learn this song.
Yes.
Whatever it is, until you learned it, sometimes it would, you know, I couldn't play everything depending on how difficult it was. But I think that does give you a lot of inspiration too, for sure.
Absolutely. And even in that aspect, you know, I'm much more of a rhythm player than anything else. Like I can do lead, but that's not what I love. I'm more of a right-hand player, so... I like to drive the percussiveness of the song with my guitar. And so every song I learned in the beginning, it was all right-hand stuff. It was strum patterns, and I didn't bother learning leads because I was a singer,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, so I would sing, and there's no reason to have to sit there and riff if you're like driving the melody as well. So, but that helped my ear. I mean, I could play to any song there is out there right now. As if it comes on the radio, I was like, oh, it's these notes, and just, you know, we could blast through it. So, yeah.
That's a good skill to have. That's what my piano teacher always yelled at me for, because it was all listening, and I was like, I would hear it, and then I would just start to memorize things, and I was never reading, and she would look at me, and she would be like, you're not reading the music, are you?
Like, but I don't need to.
I don't need it.
Yeah, like, get it out of here. Just clear it out. No, I mean, I think that's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, sure. Like, I think that you excel more the more you study, obviously. There is a point to where you shelf. If all you're doing is playing by ear, you can't move beyond it, because there's a lot more structure in knowing some of those scales and patterns. And this goes right back to making fertilizer. This whole thing. It's like you can get a certain distance with NPK, but if you really want to go into it, you're going to have to dive in and learn and get, you know, get more knowledge.
Yeah. So where do you think you see the business going, or kind of what are your goals with that?
Growth. You know, we've got some cool new stuff coming out that'll be available both in the pro and DIY side. Here's a question: when is this going to air?
We have no idea. I mean, it could be tomorrow. Oh, it could be 3 days.
Good. I'll get Brad. If it's tomorrow, it's fine. I'll get Brad a heart attack. So we have, we're coming up on overseeding time right now. We have a product coming out called Green Pop. 1621-2 that also has humic and kelp, and, you know, does what we know really well, but a good dose of FOS. And we've been running that out around the country for like 8 months. I've had different people using it that are really excited to start talking about it, and I've been like, hold on, you know. So we're on the pro side. That's going to be out and available, shipping August 15th. So we're already taking orders for all that, and we're producing now. We're going to have to hold a little bit back, but, you know, the plan is to be in our seeding pack, which we sell currently, that's got 901, 1801, RGS. We're going to include a gallon in that. So if there's anybody out there that's like getting ready to do seeding and they're looking at that seed pack, maybe just hold on a little bit so you can get this Green Pop. There's a method to how that'll be applied. You're going to be putting basically like an RGS app down plus this right at seeding, 901 about 21 days later, 1801 after that. So it's got a real mathematical way to grow the grass in.
Is that on the soil then? Putting it on the
drip? Right on the seed.
Okay.
Yeah, you can do it right then. Because it's you want to give... So we've been FOS-free for a long time, and this is actually a good opportunity to talk about this and why this is happening. The reason that we were FOS-free is a lot of the areas where we were strongest in the beginning had like phosphorus bans. You couldn't have it in fertilizer, so there was no reason for us to even have it. The original formula that I did make had FOS in it way back, and then I just pulled it from everything. As we were able to see what we needed to see out of the plant growth and vigor with what we were doing, so it went away. And it had been in conversation for about the last 2 years, is why don't we just go ahead and have a liquid starter? Because that's essentially what this is. It's a starter fertilizer. And it's like, yeah, you know, well, let's see if there's really even a demand for it. And whatever. And so, like, yeah, the second you put the feelers out, it's like, you know, get us that. When are you going to have it? It's like, ah, crap. So now we have to do it. But I wanted to take my time with it too. So it was in the works last year. And then we put it together the way that I wanted it. We had to, you know, lab it for a while. You know, we had to test it, how it was holding up, make sure everything was working well together. And then I started like, hey, you know, I got this stuff. You want to try like 5 gallons of this? And
putting
like, you
have this. Out.
Yeah. And then we started shipping it around. And then I have a few companies with that had phosphorus deficiencies that I was like, hey, you know, we've got totes of that. And I'm like, great, let's do it. Freaking love it. They're all like, when, you know, we need more. So it's something that you don't just say one day, hey, I'm making this, who wants it tomorrow? It's like all of the stuff that we've done, it's been like almost a year behind before we ever get it out into anybody's hands anyway. So that's coming, this Green Pop. And again, I'll make Brad really upset. So what our goal is here is he wants to say September 1 is our safe zone for having gallons of that, because, you know, it's going to be kind of a busy little hairy time. I'm pushing everybody to more like an August 21st time. So just be looking for it. We're probably going to get it up on sites that say it'll be available to ship at a certain time, but we're going to beat the deadline that we put up there. And also, we just opened up the states that we haven't been able to ship to. Mm-hmm. Idaho, Oregon, California, Washington, they're all, you know, people can get everything there now, too.
So. Yeah, that's been one of the major questions mm-hmm. I see on a lot of videos.
All the time.
All the regulation, and when do I get this, and when can I, yeah.
So it's mm-hmm. we're now officially shipping. As of today, we made the announcement today. So that's going now, and we'll see what happens. Maybe the four people who really wanted it out there are going to finally get it.
There might be a few more.
It could be. It could be a couple. So it's good, and it's fun. You know, honestly, I've had a lot of fun with the DIY community. Again, it's not anything that I really ever interfaced with. So, you know, having people send me the stories of their lawns, it's so fun. It's mm-hmm. like, wow, you know, this person... You know, they invested, they went in, and look at this. Like, and they're just so proud of it. Like, yep. This is amazing. This is my piece of heaven. And so that's really fun. I've never, you know.
Yeah.
For me, it's always been the business aspect. It's like I work with business owners. I work with guys who've never applied a product in their life, but they're starting a lawn care company. I'm like, here's how you do it. This is your ground-up build. You know, don't focus so much on this, like, the science side. You need to be good at business. And so much of the coaching is like, here's how you advertise, you know, here's how you talk, here's how you do this. I said, what I need you to do is grow your business and I'll grow your grass. Mm-hmm. Like that's what I tell all my guys, like who are out in the fields, like we've got the products. Don't even worry about it. You focus on getting customers. And so that's been really fun to like bring people through. And then they, you know, they get really into it. Like, well, tell me, you know, I really want to be able to explain this, you know?
Yeah.
So, and that's why those, you know, like the Lawncology thing's grown like crazy because people want it, you know, they're like, wow, mm-hmm. I want to learn about that, but I also want to know how to grow my business, yep. you know? So it's pretty fun.
Yeah. That was a great time last year when I was at that, for sure.
That was it was intense. A lot of people. Mm-hmm. It was just too small a space.
Yeah.
Which I, to be honest, I kind of intended. I'm like, let's oversell it a little so we have to do something bigger next year. Make a sense of urgency for people to get signed up. But it was really fun. You know, a lot of good camaraderie. That's what I really like is when everybody kind of comes together and shares what they've done in their businesses, how they're growing. It's just a good exchange. It's mm-hmm. a really good exchange.
Yeah. I've gotten some of those emails and stuff recently too with people who send me pictures or things of their yard and they're like, oh, you taught me how to do. I was like, I don't really think about it when I'm making videos that I'm really teaching people things. I mean, that's the whole point of it, that hopefully they'll catch a few things each video that they're like, oh, I didn't know about that. But that's I don't set out necessarily with that mindset of that I'm doing that all the time, and then people send me that stuff. I'm like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and I think that there's maybe another piece that people don't really realize is like sometimes we just try things.
That's mainly all that I do.
So you're just showing that it's okay. Like, and I think that it's really important for like creators and influencers to show when we screw up. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, this is what happens. You know, like, you know, I got a little excited here, but, you know, maybe it's an opportunity to fix it. Maybe it's an opportunity to not do anything and just say, let's see how long this takes to fix itself. But it's never perfect.
Yep.
It's never perfect. And if it were, it would be boring as hell. And that's, I've started saying that now every time. Perfection sucks. Just work with what you got and keep making it better. I always had this saying, like, you know, when people say, well, we're the best. It's like, well, guess what? There's always a better. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as best because there's always a better. So you want to learn and you want to, you know, go through some mistakes and try things and do this, especially if you're, you know, it's your little kingdom. You know, you've got your backyard kingdom. This is where people come and hang out. It's where kids, grandkids, dogs, you know, whatever. And just because a dog treats it like a bathroom doesn't mean it should look bad. You know, like let's have some fun with it.
Yep. That's the thing that's been a little bit, I wouldn't say it's concerning to me, but it's been a little bit more this year on YouTube. I feel like there's just been a little more kind of overall negativity about a lot of different things where it feels like you can't just do an experiment. And that's basically what I've done since I started my channel was mm-hmm. like, hey, I feel like trying this now.
Sure.
And then there's all this like, oh, you're ruined everything. You know, you don't know, whatever the case is, but it's just how it goes.
It is online. And some of those people maybe it's genuine. You know, some people are like truly invested in you, like, but that's my lawn, Ryan.
Yeah.
Why are you doing this to my lawn? I love my lawn. You're like, well, but then, you know, there's others that are just the clanging cymbal. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. You know, like if you've got 100,000 followers and you have two or three people that are making noise, what?
Yeah.
That's not, who cares?
Yeah.
You know, like, they have their own lawn journey that they're going to go on. And I think life for them is really hard. Yeah. I really feel for them. I'm surprised they own a computer because many of them, it just seems like in the way they speak, they live on the street. I'm just kidding, but
Yeah. It's true. I think they are, for sure they are invested, which is good.
It is good.
And any changes happen, even for someone in their normal life, a lot of changes are hard for people, but the way I look at it is I'm just trying things for fun and whatever happens,
right.
I make more videos about it.
That's true. And that's the thing is we, again, always have to be learning, right? And for me, I have this back catalog in here of products that I have seen come and go and, you know, be in the industry, especially because it always is on the pro side first, right? So there's products that come out there before they're ever released anywhere else. And so, you know, it's one of those like ask me anythings. If you have a question about a product, I probably know it. I might even know the people who make it, you know, just from being in the industry, and I can walk you through it. And at the end of the day, I honestly use what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't use what you're being told to use. Like, there's a lot of that too, and I really want to clarify that for people. It's like I manufacture fertilizer for a living, and I have for a long time. And a few people now know about us, like in the last 18 months. They're like, wow, well, this company and where. But the reality is, push a spreader if it's easier.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I can help you to grow better grass by giving you something that works, then I'm going to do it. But don't buy because people say buy.
Mm-hmm.
Buy because it works. And buy because it works for your method and the way that you process things and how you... Don't overcomplicate.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
That's a lot of the thing that I try to say on my channel when there's certain things like that of people who say, well, I just don't think this would work or, okay.
Yeah.
Trying to tell you to do anything. You do whatever you want to do. I don't care. I mean,
yeah, well, and you're going to find out if it does or not.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole thing is like, I put it out and, well, nothing, you know, or wow. Yeah. Whatever it is, you know, you're going to have a walk in moment. Wow. Look at the grass, you know, like, you know, you don't, but you know, you're going to try it because for a lot of people now with the way, you know, technology is and it's harder to really find real information about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's great to be able to pick up a bottle or a bag of something, put it out and say, here is what I like. Here's what I don't like. Here's what worked. Here's what didn't work. And when people relate to you, say, okay, great. You know, I relate to this guy, so I think like this guy, so maybe this isn't the product for me, or maybe it is. And it's so much easier than it ever was to figure out what you do and don't want, mm-hmm. because it's like, okay, that didn't work. And, you know, or there's first thing anybody ever did. I mean, before, like, we were doing tons of products on, you know, when people talking about it on YouTube for lawn care, what do? You get on, you read reviews. It's Review Central.
Mm-hmm.
And you pick out the ones that you know are fake. And then you read, you know, you're like, you want to find those like 3 stars. Like, okay, these people, you know, that's what I want to listen to these guys and see if it's worth it or not. Restaurants, the whole thing, you know, you have to kind of wade through and we're willing to take the risk. But nobody's reputation's ever on the line.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, it failed. So guess what I'm doing? Reseeding the lawn. You know, like, woohoo. Don't buy that stuff. It was bad.
Yep.
That's all. It's just an adventure.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. A lawn exciting adventure.
All the time.
That's it. It's really lawn.
Well, I think we've come to that time, John.
I think so too. That was long.
I think we need to go eat something.
Eat, drink, be merry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. Well, hey.
My wife is shaking her head yes.
So. Yes, yeah. If it's like the dogs, or they're even upset about it.
But I do appreciate you kind of stopping by, chatting with me. And
yeah, man.
It's been fun.
Yeah,
we're
thanks.
We're going to go have some more fun, but...
Thanks for having me in the shed. It's something.
Yep.
I like it. I appreciate it, buddy.
No problem.
All right.
Talk at y'all later.
See you, everybody.